about Itaros Chalom and Kainos Chalom.
What was the first thing? Hatavas Chalom?
Yeah,
Hatavas,
I think.
Hatavas. Yeah, well, you know, the if you learn Maseches Brachos, you know that the almost the bulk of the ninth chapter is a very long agadata on the meaning of dreams. And Chazal have different deis, and all you can say is some dreams are prophecy, some dreams are premonitions about the future, some dreams are just the indigestion or fears that you have. Meaning to say, Chazal give us a guideline, which is not a real guideline because it can mean anything, and says, just like all grain has chaff, all dreams will have things that are not really taken seriously. On the other hand, there is also a kernel of truth in a dream. So a dream, the Gemara says, is 1/60th of prophecy. There is something in a dream that is prophetic. So consequently, if a person does have a bad dream, it might be, not necessarily, it might be a message from Hashem that, God forbid, something bad is going to happen. Or it might just be anxiety, it might be fear, it might be, right, so you don't know. So in case it is a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so we take steps to seek divine mercy that the dream should not be a negative thing. And there are two ideas that the Gemara, actually three ideas that the Gemara mentions. One idea is fasting, that one can fast, one should fast. I'll talk about today, if one has a bad dream, based on the idea that a fast is a form of atonement. And this fast is so important that even on Shabbos, one is allowed to fast for a bad dream. But because of the sin of fasting on Shabbos, you have to fast another day to make up for the sin of fasting on Shabbos. But don't choose Shabbos to for the makeup, because then you'll have to have a third makeup. So, you know, okay. That is called Tainus Chalom. Now, Tainus Chalom can be done today, and there are people who do it today. On the other hand, many people say that because we are a weaker generation, because when we fast, it's hard for us to daven, hard for us to learn, so we tend to discourage people from assuming these types of fasts. So as an alternative to a fast for a dream, we have a ceremony that is called Hatavas Chalom. Hatavas Chalom is making the dream good. And I think maybe the Archbishop Sitter may even have this. And this is similar to Hataras Tadarim, although it's a different word. In other words, you stand before three people that function as a Beis Din. You say over what your dream is in very general ways, and the Beis Din then paskins. It'll be a good dream, and the theory is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shemayim obeys the decisions of the Beis Din on earth. But even there, the Iker is not so much the ceremony, but it's Tshuva Tefillah Tzedaka, take away the evil decree. In fact, that is even recited as part of that Tavas Chalom. There is a third thing that's mentioned in the Gemara, and it's very interesting that we don't do it in Israel. And I'll explain why. And that is, the Gemara says, while the Kohanim are duchening, when they recite the Birchas Kohanim, right? Those of you that may have the ancient memories from the pre-life you had in Chutz La'aretz before you came here, may recall that, unless you're Sephardic, Ashkenazim, only duchen, of course, in the Musaf of Yom Tov. And between the verses, after Yerecha Hashem Yishmerecha, the Kohanim sing, and we recite a prayer that's called Ribono Shalolam. If I had a bad dream, may it be annulled, may it be turned into something good. And this is actually in the Gemara itself. The Gemara in Sefer says that it's an auspicious time. Now, you don't say it while the Kohanim are reciting the verses, but in between the verses, it is an auspicious good time to pray for the dreams being turned into something good. The interesting question is that in Eretz Yisrael, at least not all of Eretz, at least Yerushalayim and most of the country, the minhag that is makubal here is that we recite Birkas Kohanim every single day. Sfaradim always did it, and the Ashkenazim did it because that was the Gra's opinion. And although the Gra could not accomplish it in Europe, his Talmidim who came to Eretz Yisrael wanted to do it here. In the Galil, by the way, in Tzfat and Tiberia, they do not duchen every day. They only duchen Musaf of Shabbos. It's still different than Chutz La'aretz. It's every Shabbos in Musaf. Okay. But the question that you could ask is, how come we do not recite the Ribono Shel Olam? Right? Yerech Hashem Yishmerecha, let's do Ribono Shel Olam. So the answer that's given, I don't really have a great answer. The only answer I saw is that because you duchen every day, and it's unlikely that every single day somebody had a bad dream, so we consider it to be unnecessary, but it is brought down, although we don't do that, that at least on the Yomim Tovim, we should say the Ribono Shel Olam even in Eretz Yisrael. Now, Mechayr, the minhag is we don't do it even then, and that's a bit of a tzorachian. But Bekitzer, to summarize this whole idea, we do believe that dreams may in fact be prophecies from Hashem. You see this in the Torah over and over again, certainly in Chumash Bereishis, when you have Yosef's dreams and Paro's dreams. Dreams are forms of prophecy, therefore they should be taken seriously, especially if the dream repeats itself, if you have a repetitive dream. That is something to be concerned with. On the other hand, it is also possible that the dreams are Devarim Vatelim, so you just don't know. So these are kind of insurance policies. Yeah.
The law of reading Unkelos in general. Read in English instead.
It's a big machlokas. You know, I think we talked previously about the idea that Chazal were misaken, that every week a person should read the Chumash twice with the Targum of Unkelos. Now, the logic of the Takana was that people didn't understand Hebrew and they spoke Aramaic. So this was a way they would understand the Parsha. Now, if that's the logic of it, that really doesn't make a lot of sense for us because Aramaic is not our language, and indeed we probably know the Hebrew better than the Aramaic. So instead of looking at the Unkelos to know the Hebrew, we might look at the Hebrew to know what the Unkelos means. So because of this, there are poskim that do say that the Bizman Hazeh, any translation that you understand, would be 100% good. Other poskim say that the Unkelos had also a special chashivas because it was written with divine inspiration. So it's hard to say. We don't have a definite halacha. The Achronim argue over this. Certainly, if one does not have the time or the Unkelos would be too difficult, certainly one should endeavor to read the parsha with the translation. And at least according to many opinions, you will be yotzei the mitzvah.
Okay, so the Gemara Chagiga limits the study of Maaseh Bereishit and Maaseh Merkavah.
Yeah.
And I know later on authorities also limit the study in a sense. And at the same time, though, we have like the letter of the Baal Shem Tov, which says Mashiach will come in the merit of the study of like Kabbalah and the deep secrets of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know, on a practical level, what's that like relevance? And also to add the point that like a lot of people in this generation who want that deep spirituality, sometimes this type of Torah study gives it to them. I'm not saying excluding other Torah studies, but with other Torah studies.
Yeah. This is, the chelak of the Torah that are called the secrets of the Torah, the Kabbalah, the mystic ideas, the understanding of God's chariot and God's essence, and how God created the world, Chazal encapsulate with two terms, Maaseh Bereishis and Maaseh Merkavah. And although there's a question with the categories, the Rambam is Mashma, Maaseh Bereishis is just science, but nevertheless, we generally understand Maaseh Bereishis is how the Almighty interacts with the world, and Maaseh Merkava goes beyond that. That's going to God's actual essence. And Chazal have many, many cautionary words how it is not wise to occupy yourself in the secrets of the Torah. We have the famous story of the four great rabbis who entered the secret garden, the paradise, the pardes, and one of them died, and one of them became crazy, and one of them became a heretic. And only Rabbi Akiva was able to successfully go in and out. And Chazal's general idea is, keep away from it, you get burnt, it can destroy you in many, many ways. So the question is, so what does that mean about studying Kabbalah today? So the short answer is that Chazal's warnings are 100% accurate, and they still apply today. However, what has happened is, from the time of the Arizal, Kabbalah has been popularized to a certain degree. And therefore, Kabbalah has been, I don't want to say diluted, but Kabbalah has been translated and reformatted in ways that a lot of its teachings can be accessible to people who are not of the highest madrega. So while it's still true that heavy-duty, real Kabbalah can be very, very dangerous, in fact, Rabbi Kaplan himself, who died very young, and I always had a theory, it was because, it was only my theory, I have no proof whatsoever, that it was connected to his being involved in Kabbalah. And there's a long history of great Mekubalim dying very young, including the Arizal himself, who died at age 39, and of Moshe Cordovero at 48. Much later, Ari Kaplan. Say again? Ramchal died young, and Ari Kaplan, you know, a recent person, died very young. But as I say, the type of touching the tip of Kabbalah that we do through Sifrei Chassidus and the like is considered to be not only not dangerous, but it's considered to be very spiritually beneficial. And as the generations get worse and worse and worse, we need a stronger, more powerful light to connect us to God. And it is said that Kabbalah might be that light that can shine into the darkness of our souls. So you're 100% correct. Many Svarim do say, as we approach the coming of Mashiach, the mystical aspect of Torah needs to be more before some, but still it has to be done through ways that are not so deep. And as deep as all of the things that we read sound like, they are really only the superficial levels, and that's a proper thing. Now, the one thing you have to be very careful of, there are a few things you need to be very, very careful of, and that is, number one, you have to be sure that you have the right teacher and or the right svarim, because there are many, many charlatans. There are many people who teach mystic doctrines of the Torah who don't even keep the mitzvahs. They don't keep the commandments. They're not knowledgeable. And what they teach, even if it has some validity on some level, might be coming from the powers of impurity. You're dealing with powerful ideas here. And when they are distorted by people who are not keeping the mitzvahs, that's a very, very dangerous thing. You must be very, very careful not to be with fakers and not to be with people who misuse these teachings in improper ways. Second of all, you have to yourself not neglect the mitzvahs in every practical way, and plus understand that your basic bread and potatoes, or meat and potatoes, has to be Shad Chumash, Shad Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, and the Kabbalah is an extra dimension that gives you light and joy, but it cannot become your ikar until you become a person of a madrega who has mastered Shas and Poskim. One cannot go to the higher levels. It's like being on the 100th story of a building when the building doesn't have the first 99 stories. Well, what's going to happen is, if you're on the 100th story and 99 stories are yanked under you, you're not going to be able to stand. You're not going to be able to survive. You need to have a foundation. And that is why the Mekubalim say over and over again that only a person who is filled with Shas and Poskim can really delve into Kabbalah. So, as I say, the type of small connection to Kabbalah that some people gravitate towards, found in Hasidic books and in some Kabbalistic books, is actually a very, very good thing. But you have to be sure that you get it from the right teachers, and that you have a foundation in Shmiras Mitzvahs and Limud HaTorah.
Questioning, Bezman Hazeh, is it possible for one to feel his soul, or is that like endorphins or something?
Well, the answer is it can be one or the other, meaning to say it's hard for us to know. Just like, for example, when people go to Rav Hillel is, a Mekubal, Rav Hillel is our local Mekubal, although I like to call him the non-Mekubal Mekubal, because like this, people are always looking for mystic reasons, and he sends them to psychologists or psychiatrists. So people come in and say, I have a D-book, I'm possessed, and because they want Rav Hillel to do, what do they call it, an exorcism. And he always sends them to a psychiatrist, So the truth of the matter is that sometimes we're so hyped up to try to sense mystical phenomena that we don't explore the naturalistic things in the Teva that Hashem puts in. So yeah, there's such a thing as endorphins. A person jogs, you can have a certain runner's high or whatever it is. But I do think it is possible for a person to feel the Neshama, because indeed, let me put it this way, whenever a person feels closeness to Hashem, whenever a person feels that they're connected to something beyond themselves, they are touching some aspect of their neshama. And according to Rav Ari Kaplan, at least, when he talks about Jewish meditation, and he wrote three works on Jewish meditation. One is Jewish meditation, one is meditation on the Bible, and the other is meditation on the Kabbalah. And this is where things get dangerous. If a person does intense meditation on God's name, you actually sense the neshama leaving the body to be connected to God. People can have and do have out of body experiences. And this is, you know, I don't do this myself, but this is a very, very dangerous thing, because sometimes when the soul leaves the body, it does not want to come back. And it has to be coaxed. That's when a person dies in the middle of a, what does it mean? A person might die in the middle of a meditation. And Rav Aryeh Kaplan writes, you have to have a buddy, like going swimming. You know, you have to have somebody there to be sure that when you would start engaging into things, you don't go too far, because then you might just, you know, your body might be here and that'll be it. You're dead. So yeah, I think it is possible. But on the other hand, as I say, you won't always know what it's due to. It's very hard for us to know.
Well, the Rav did teach us, why does the Orthodox world wear black and white?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is, that's a relatively recent phenomenon. If you ever looked at pictures of the yeshiva guys in Europe, including, I said, of Steinman, you know, different people, the people who only wear black today, you actually see that essentially the dress of the Litvishit, now Hasidim had their own dress always, but if you talk about the Litvishit, the non-Hasidic yeshiva world, you actually see that their fashion was whatever was the contemporary fashion of a gentleman, of a dapper gentleman. The idea of a hat that's at an angle and a tie and sometimes a colored shirt and a light colored suit. And even the idea of a hat. Now, there are halachas about wearing a hat during davening, it's a separate thing, but the idea of a hat was introduced because any dignified gentleman always had a hat. That was true even in America until John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy destroyed the hat industry because every other president at any occasion always wore a hat. Every person who went to work wore a hat. Look at pictures in the 50s. Kennedy wanted to convey youthfulness in the middle of January winter in D.C. You know, he took the presidential oath without a hat. So that destroyed the hat industry. Now, the only people who wear hats in America are Orthodox Jews and blacks for some reason. African Americans like hats. I don't know exactly why they still have that minna. So in Europe, it was not actually the practice to wear black and white. In Europe, the yeshiva boys dressed the way a gentleman dressed. There was a cheshbon for that. There was actually a cheshbon for that. There was a big emphasis, and you might even think too much of an emphasis, on B'nai Torah looking fashionable in their dress. Why was that so? Because B'nai Torah were often derided. People often thought these were people who, you know, didn't have, you know, dignity, they didn't have self-respect, they were poor, they often didn't have food. So it was thought, the Altar of Slobodka, for example, held it was very, very important for a Ben Torah to look very dignified. That gave them a sense of internal pride, and that was important psychologically that they should continue to learn. Now, what happened over the past maybe 60 years, you know, in different ways and in different places, was that B'nai Torah became a bit more insular, meaning they began to separate more and more from the secular world, because the secular world became more decadent, it became more anti-religious, etc. And as a result, there came this idea that instead of trying to look like the rest of the world, which actually was the levush in Europe, to look like a fashionable Polish gentleman, the theory actually became the opposite way, to kind of separate from the world by wearing a distinct garment, similar to a uniform, because just like a uniform, whether it's an army uniform or a sports uniform, that's how you tell the members of your team. So this became a point of pride, almost not to be fashionable, to kind of just, you know, separate from the fashions and colors of the world. But it's a relatively recent phenomenon. It's connected to the Chazon Ish and the like. And I think it actually started in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, it started, then it's now spread to America as well. But the black thing started here. Now, the one thing is that in the ultimate scheme of things, this is not important at all. That's important to know. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not care if your hat is black or brown or blue or white. He may care if you wear a hat, that's a separate issue, but he doesn't care what the hat is. It could be a straw hat and the like. And sometimes, in fact, even the expression we have in Israel for Dati Liumi, right? We describe them by Chitzonius, Kipas Ruga, Nidid Yamaka. as if, you know, that makes a big difference. So the truth of the matter is, it is also, I think, evidence of the superficiality of our tikkufa, that we describe people by matters of dress. Dress is essentially has some psychological importance because you become part of a group. It's a group solidarity thing, which has a certain importance, but it's certainly much, much more secondary. What Hashem looks at is your heart and your Torah and your mitzvos and the sincerity by which you serve Him, and it makes no difference, really, how you are dressed as long as you're dressed according to the laws of tznius and proper respect for davening. But it is interesting that the... look, even when I was in yeshiva, the truth is, when I was in yeshiva, which was not that long ago, I mean, I was in the 1970s, even very, very chashuva people wore blue shirts, or I remember even pink shirts, although that was a little... pink was a little discouraged. And when I look at pictures of the suits that I myself wore in the 1970s, I would be absolutely embarrassed. I mean, there is no possible. It was a matter. I can't even believe it. But I remember at the time, it did not seem that unusual. In fact, you guys know Chanoch Teller, the author. He lives this year. In one of his books about the Boston Rebbe. Because I was in Boston in the 1970s, I was in law school. He has a picture of Havdalah at the Boston Rebbe. So I'm actually in that picture. And for some reason, I turned around, so I'm looking right at the camera. I don't know why I just turned around. And you can actually—I won't tell you the name of the book. You can actually see the suit that I wore then, which is very, very embarrassing. Okay. I think it's—I'm not 100% sure. I think it is me. I'm not 100% sure, but that's what the people tell me. But anyway, okay. But as I say, don't worry about it. Yeah.
You discussed when you eat at other people's houses, what's your obligation to make sure they're keeping kosher, slash at what level they're keeping kosher? Do you even have to check? If so, how much checking?
Well, you know, theoretically, you know, you don't eat at someone's house unless you know they're kosher. I mean, that is a rule. So if your non-religious aunt invites you for Shabbos, you have to be sure the food is kosher. Right now, the question becomes, if you're invited to a Shomer Shabbos person, a person who keeps Shabbos, a person, but maybe they're not yeshivish, maybe they don't dress in black, right? Maybe, right, they're dati lumi, they don't wear a jacket in shul. They wear the white shirt without the tie. So it's complicated because in reality, any Jew that is Shomer Shabbos has what is called a cheskas kashrus. A cheskas kashrus means a presumption that if they keep Shabbos and they daven, or at least it looks like they keep Shabbos, you don't know if they daven, you know, you can assume that they're kosher. If they're not Shomer Shabbos, you need to make an investigation. But what is complicated, so technically speaking, if you're invited to a Shomer Shabbos, you don't have to ask any questions whatsoever. But the reason why in Israel it is more complicated is that in Israel we have many, many different types of hashgachos and many, many different levels. So my answer to your question would be the following. You first have to determine, by talking to your rabbi or rebbe or whatever it is, what is your personal standard of hashgacha. For example, do you rely on the Rabbanut as a certifying agency, or do you require what are called Mahadran Hashgachas? Now, I'm not telling you what to decide, that you have to talk to your Rebbe, although I will tell you that in the yeshiva world, we generally rely only on Mahadran Hashgachas, but okay. Now, I can tell you that a Dati Liumi person, at worst, will rely on Rabbanut, and often will rely on better. So, if your standard is Rabbanut, you can eat without any question. You don't have to ask any question at all, because it's a davar pashut that they're going to at least use Rabbanut. If, however, you have decided with the psak of your rebbeim that you need to eat at a mahadran level hashgacha, then I think you'd have to make inquiry, because there's absolutely no presumption that a dati liumi would require a mahadran. In other words, all I'm saying is your duty of inquiry is a function of the standard of kashrus that you have incorporated.
So they have to keep a separate standard in your house when you eat at other people's houses? I hear, but
generally speaking, it's good to be consistent. Now, if you're stuck in a situation where you weren't aware, and then you're served something that is not in accordance with your normal hashgacha, then it could very well be that the mitzvah of not embarrassing somebody, and the the mitzvah of showing respect to a fellow Jew might indicate under those circumstances that you can give yourself an emergency heter to deviate from your normal standard. That might very well be so. However, you don't l'chatchila say, I mean, that's like, you know, there are some people who say, I keep kosher at home, but I eat out, or whatever, or vice, you know, whatever it is. Now, I'm not saying this is the same thing, but by analogy, it's somewhat the same. So I would differentiate between, you know, you're stuck somewhere versus you know ahead of time that it may not be the Mahadrin. So, and the truth of the matter is, I mean, some people do get offended. I can't tell you that it'll be smooth sailing. But often, you know, if you communicate ahead of time that, you know, and you don't even have to say it's what you do. You can say, you can blame it on us, blame it on the Rebbe, and blame it on the yeshiva. You know, I know it's pretty stupid, but the yeshiva I belong to says it has to be Mahadrin. It shouldn't be said in a way that puts the host down in any way. But they'll be happy to accommodate you, usually, and they understand. And in Israel, I think there is a certain understanding that people have these different levels and people try to accommodate. But as I say, if you are at somebody's house and l'maisa, something is served, if they're Shomer Shabbos, at least b'di'evit, you could absolutely be somech on their cheskes kashrus. Although I'll tell you an interesting story with the Ger Rebbe. This is like this is the former Ger Rebbe, like 50 years ago, that there was a person who used to visit the Ger Rebbe like every Yom Tov to get a bracha, and he would always bring the Ger Rebbe a gift of chopped liver, whatever it is for Yom Tov. He would make the chopped liver, bring it as a matzah to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe ate it at the Yom Tov meal without any hesitation. Anyway, this chopped liver was so good that people kept on telling the guy, you know, you have to open a restaurant or open a hotel, open a restaurant. So he opened up, so he went to the Rebbe for a breakfast. The Rebbe says, oh yeah, it's good schmuck, you make good stuff. Sure, open your business. All right, he opens his business. He's very matzliach. The first Yom Tov, after he opens his business, he brings the liver to the same liver he always brought to the Rebbe, which he brought for 25 years. And the Rebbe says, what's your hashkacha? You know, who's your mashgiach on this liver? So the person says, well, I mean, I've been bringing it to the Rebbe 25 years. So the Rebbe said, when you were a private citizen bringing me from your own kitchen, of course I trust you. You're a chassid, you're a Shomer Shabbos. Once you're in business, you need a mashgiach. Once you're in business, you might cut corners, etc. So the Ger Rebbe would not eat from the restaurant chopped liver, although it was made by the same guy, because he needed hashgacha. That's just an idea that even somebody who's kosher, because kosher could be changed once you have economic incentives for them.
How did they clean the Kodesh HaKodesh?
Yeah, so, well, it's not clear that they cleaned it, but the Gemara gives a protocol, a very interesting protocol, that, you know, the Beis HaMikdash had a second story, which was really kind of an attic. It wasn't used for anything. But over the Kodesh HaKodeshim, there was like a skylight. So they would lower workers in a box through the Kodesh HaKodeshim. So they would be in a box, and the box only had holes to put their arms through. So the concept would be, you're a worker, you're in this box, you don't see what's in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, but you put your hands, and apparently they were able to map it out, and you knew where to scrub or where to do everything, but you actually did not visually see the Kodesh HaKodeshim. The Gemara actually describes that, and that was a skylight in the second story of the Beis HaMikdash that was over the Kodesh HaKodeshim.
How do we know that, the Baal Shem Tov had some sort of divine revelation? How can we rely on that as the foundation of all Hasidus?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if you have to rely on that as a foundation. In other words, Hasidus, I don't think, rises or falls on any type of specific divine revelation. The Baal Shem Tov was a tzaddik. I mean, we know that. The way we know, I mean, how do you know the Chafetz Chaim was a tzaddik? And we know this from the stories that are passed down. The Baal Shem Tov was a teacher. He taught ways of serving Hashem. There were many, many great disciples who followed those ways, and they continue this very day. So it doesn't, it's not like Matan Torah. It doesn't stand or fall on a specific idea of divine inspiration. I mean, let's say that didn't happen. But the Baal Shem Tov taught a derech in Avodas Hashem, that brings people to HaKadosh, close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that itself would be very good.
Just to follow up on that,
yeah.
If we're, yeah, there's a time issue in the sense that, like, if we You learn this about, this is part of the Nefesh.
Oh, you have a Tanya Shiva Center?
Yeah.
Oh, who gives it? Very nice. No, no, okay. I'll write that down. Okay, yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Okay.
There's a Tanya Shiva and one of the Musa Shiva.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, you have this part of the Nefesh and this and the Lev. How can I'm really asking, how can we rely that's how?
No, you have to understand. See, one thing you have to understand, that the Tanya's basic structure, this basic, what you might call existential structure of the souls, is not the Chiddush, is not the invention of the Alter Rebbe, it's not the invention of the Baal Shem Tov. It is from the Arizal. The Tanya is a work that attempts to bring the realm of Kabbalah into the realm of personal psychology. In other words, like this. The Arizal, actually, the Babaji Rebbe once said it very, very nicely. He said, what is the difference between Hasidus and Kabbalah? Listen to this. He said, the relationship of Hasidus to Kabbalah is like the relationship of medicine to anatomy. This is really very, very beautiful, because anatomy describes the structure. All the bones, all the muscles, all the ligaments, all the organs. But it doesn't tell you what to do about it. It doesn't tell you how to heal diseases. But you need to have to understand the structure, and then you can get into medicine as to how to fix things. So the Babaji Rebbe said that if you would learn the Kabbalah of the Ari, which is really very much beyond us, essentially you're learning the anatomy of the spiritual universe. But it doesn't necessarily give you any practical lessons how to apply it. This, that, this world, that world. No, there's just worlds and angels and forces. Okay, but what do I do? What do I do with all of that? So what Chassidus tried to do was, Chassidus tried to take the teachings of the Ari and show how it applies to the sicknesses of the soul and the problems we have in the service of God. So Chassidus is the medicine that is based on the anatomy, the anatomical structure of Kabbalah. So when the Baal HaTanya writes about different levels of soul, he is really, that is just taken from the Ari. So you may want to ask me, how do we know the Ari had Ruach HaKodesh? Okay, that's going back much further. But suffice it to say, that's what everybody was makabel. And what can I tell you? We have an unbroken tradition of the greatness of the Ari. Now, what the Tanya's contribution, if we can talk about the Tanya's contribution to Judaism, was not so much the anatomy of the Ari, but it was applying it to the struggles we have with our Yetzer Hara. And how we understand this anatomical structure, we can become closer to Hashem by understanding our ups and our downs, and by understanding that when we struggle to serve God, that is not a defeat and that is not a failure, but that is exactly how we open our souls to experience the love and fear of God. So the Tanya, again, I'm simplifying obviously, the Tanya is a book of psychology. It's ethical psychology in terms of understanding the spiritual dynamics and struggles within you as a basis of becoming closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? But I tell you the truth, it's much less based on the Baal Shem Tov than it is directly on their Arizal. Yeah.
So, kind of on that topic, can you explain us like the concept of what a Benoni is and like,
the Tanya begins with a bunch of questions, right? If you learn Perek Aleph, a bunch of questions. Those questions are not answered till around Perek Lamed Aleph. Right? So there are many, many chapters until he actually gets. There are digressions and other things and foundations, but you don't get an answer to the question till almost the last third of the first Sefer, which is the main part of the Tanya. But essentially, the bottom line, to give you a very, very bottom line, is that the Baal HaTanya says that 99.9% of the world are Beinonim. And in the category of the Beinoni can be sometimes the greatest Gadol Hador, and it can be the almost the biggest bum. Because the concept is the Beinoni is the one who lives in the world of struggle. You struggle. You have a Yetzer Tov, you have a Yetzer Hara, and you struggle. You could be a Tzaddik, who normally wins. You could be what we call a Rasha, who normally loses. But as long as you're in the game, you're a Beinoni. Now, according to the Baal HaTanya, the definition of a tzaddik is very different than the Rambam. A tzaddik is not somebody who has more mitzvahs than averus. You can still be a Beinoni. A tzaddik is somebody who has destroyed the Yetzer Hara and no longer struggles. And therefore, that's a gift from Hashem, and he says, and that's a very rare thing, and even the greatest person we call a tzaddik is not on that level. And for Keret, we sometimes say the greater you are, the stronger your Yetzer Hara. Okay? So let me explain. Now, why did the Baal HaTanya articulate such a radical understanding of a Beinoni? Like, what's the purpose of doing that? So there are two reasons. The first reason is a very technical reason, and that is, if Beinoni simply means you're equally balanced, I mean, how often is somebody going to be equally balanced? I mean, you know, if at 10 o'clock you're equally balanced and you were rude to somebody, so now you're not anymore. In other words, like, you know, minute by minute, second by second, I'm going to change. And it's not mashma that way. It's mashma that tzaddik, rasha, beinoni are fundamental categories of life. They are not ephemeral things that change by the millisecond. That's the technical reason. The more important spiritual reason is, and this goes back to the idea that the Tanya is a work of spiritual psychology. If you looked at the Hakdama of the Alter Rebbe, as Chabad calls him, the old Rebbe, because he was the founder of Chabad, you will see that he writes that, why did he write the Tanya? Because so many people were coming to him for talks and chizuk, and after a while he couldn't see everybody. So he wrote kundresim, he wrote pamphlets to be able to give people the chizuk that they could not get by an in-person conference. And those pamphlets were copied and recopied and recirculated, and then he noticed that there were mistakes and people were not always writing it accurately, so he decided he had to write it himself. By the way, Tanya was, there is a first edition of Tanya that was never published, that Chabad came out with a while ago. It actually was Ksav Yad, an early edition of the Machlokas. Should we look at the early edition or not? The Alter Rebbe himself was not Mefarsim. But here's the point. One of the big problems that the Alter Rebbe faced was that people who were struggling to serve God were very depressed by their failures and their mistakes. And they thought that they're further and further and further from Hashem, and they can never come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So his point is, no. Even with your failures, as long as you're struggling, you are the Beinoni. So in a technical sense, even if you sin once, you're a Rasha. But in the category of the Beinoni, who has the koach of coming close to God, you are just the Beinoni. So the purpose was to give chizuk to people who were very, very depressed. That's really the thesis. So that's why I think, you know, there are different perspectives. When you learn a sefer, sometimes if you give yourself a certain mental orientation towards the sefer, it can become very pleasurable because you then have a sense of the road that you're being taken on. And I will tell you this, that although the Tanya has much Kabbalah in it, and the Tanya is a deep sefer, and the Tanya is a complicated sefer, but if you think about this, the Alter Rebbe is trying to communicate the holiness of your soul, the goodness of your inner essence, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a tremendous love for Am Yisrael, and the fact that love of Hashem and Yiras Hashem are not things you have to learn. They are things already within you that you just have to unlock. And if you understand that that is what the Alter Rebbe is trying to tell you, don't be, you know, debilitated by the mistakes that you make, and go on and know that there's always hope. You can then understand that the highways and byways and the subtleties are all designed to keep you on that path. I think you'll get more hana from the sefer by understanding that. Yeah.
Are there still rashas today?
What? Say again?
Rashas, Rashamin?
Yeah.
And if so, how can we understand the commandment to hate a rasha?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a whole chapter in the Tanya on this, a very, very famous chapter. The Baal HaTanya says that, it's a chiddush, he says that there has to be simultaneous love and hate. He says, you must love the goodness, we're talking about Jews for now at least, you must love the goodness and the holiness that is within every Jew, no matter how far he has strayed. Because within every single Jew, there is holiness and goodness and godliness, which you must love. But you must hate. It's kind of hating the actions. You hate the actions. You hate. It's like a person that had a beautiful, a person had a beautiful treasure that he was desecrating and messing up. You know, you might be very upset. And so really, when you hate the Russia, you're upset at what he's doing to himself, the beauty that is with him. So psychologically, that's a difficult exercise. But he says there is a concept of loving and hating simultaneously. Okay? Yeah, I think I have to... we'll take one more question. Yeah. I'll take two more questions. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to know, in regards to, like, it's in general Judaism, but I guess it's a little bit more specific in Hasidut, I guess, that, like, there's different, quote-unquote, modes of serving Hashem, like different drachim, I guess. The ultimate goal is getting to Hashem, but there's different drachim. So
yeah.
I want to know, especially, you know, us, we're just becoming more religious now, how to identify, you know, where and what path to take, whether it's breast love or Chabad or, you know, different things, you know what I'm saying? Like, because...
Well, I would recommend the Or Sameach path, of course. But, what you're identifying is a very important point, and the short answer is I don't have a good answer for you. Meaning to say, a young person especially, you have to taste and look around. Meaning to say, let me put it this way. Every Jew who wants a relationship with Hashem has a common foundation of Torah, mitzvot, limud HaTorah. That has to be it. Any derech that is not going to encompass or incorporate those examples is not a truly legitimate path, okay? That's the first thing. Now, when you've made that commitment and you're following that, at that point, chassidus, Kabbalah, what type of chassidus, what derech, this very much depends. Because you have to understand, with these derechim, there is no true or false, contrary to what people might think. Rather, just as there were 12 tribes, and each shevet had its own derech. And just as there were 12 gates, there were actually 13 gates to the Beis HaMikdash. Each tribe had its shevet, had its gate. And if you didn't know, there was a 13th gate that worked for everybody. But so too, some neshamos are attuned to Musar, and some neshamos are attuned to Chassidus, and some neshamos are attuned to music, and some neshamos are attuned to Chesed, and involvement with people and the like. So you have to see what gives you chizuk, what gives you life, what gives you excitement, what gives you vibrancy, and you have to try to pursue that. What can I tell you?
Can you take different mix and matches?
You can. You can mix and match, but when you get into actual halakhas, you know, one has to be consistent. So for example, it would be perfectly okay for an Ashkenazic person to adopt certain Sephardic minhagim or vice versa. But you'd have to talk to a Rav or a Posek about that, because you do get into a certain halachic questions. For example, an Ashkenazic person couldn't simply say, I want to eat rice on Pesach. Whatever, can't do that, and the like. So certain minhagim are just kind of optional ways of glorifying God, which, you know, anybody can do if they want. Huh?
Gartel, for example?
Yeah, a gartel might be something. Again, there's no iser for an Ashkenazic person to wear a gartel. But again, in Eretz Yisrael in particular, in America too, because we do label people, and that's not, maybe it's not a good thing. Maybe it's not a good thing. It is not a good thing. You know, sometimes if you do minhagim that are a little out of your community, you know, it may be difficult for you. So that is a factor to consider. Don't do things that are blatantly and publicly different than your tzibur. But privately, there could be different things. I mean, and again, I think this changed, because I will tell you that 40, 50 years ago, you know, many mainstream yeshiva people wore gartels. It wasn't like only a certain group. It was a very widespread thing. Now it kind of becomes, you know, you don't do it in your group, etc. But as I say, one should find a derech that gives them excitement and gives them his chadshus. That's a very, very important thing. And chassidus can work for many people. Other people, you know, whatever. But I'll tell you this, again, in my own few years, I mean, I've seen big changes. It used to be in the Litvashi yeshiva world, a Hasidic swarm were not studied at all. You would never have a Tanya Shir in the Litvashi yeshiva. You wouldn't have Nesiva Shalom, because it wasn't written then, Svas Emes, Rav Sado. Now, to a greater or lesser degree, these swarm are in every yeshiva, every Litvashi yeshiva. Is very, very interesting, because people need the chizuk and the light and the inspiration that these svarim bring. I'll tell you, we can actually credit, we can come out credit one person who did this. Who brought Chassidus into the Litvisha learning? In Europe, it was not so. It was Rav Dessler, Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who was a traditional Baal Musar from Kelim, but he brought Sifrei Chassidus into Panovich, and from Panovich it spread. And there were some of his colleagues, some of the elder Mashgichim, were very much against what he did. They said, what are you bringing in this stuff? This is not our Masorah. But he held that it was very Kedai. And in the United States, the one person who did it was Rav Huttner. So it's really, and so in a sense, these were revolutionaries in terms of bringing the world of Chassidus into the Lishbashi Yeshiva world. Rav Dessler here, Rav Huttner in America. I should also add another person who was not a Rosh Yeshiva, but a phenomenal pioneer. You should read his biography, Rav Shraga Feigl of Lovitch, who was not a Rosh Yeshiva, but he built and created the yeshivas that spread Torah in America. And he was a combination. He was Hungarian yet, but he wanted a Litvishi yeshiva. He started Torah Vadas to be a Litvishi yeshiva with a Hasidish enthusiasm. And the Torah Vadas to this day is kind of that way. So if someone has one more question, I'll take, yeah.
Okay. A lot of intense religious experience, it seems like, especially kind of mysticism that we've been talking about today, seems to, in terms of its symptoms, seems to mirror what modern society would call mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just kind of wondering how we know how to delineate between the two.
Yeah, I do have to go, unfortunately, but I will tell you this. There is a religious psychologist in Yerushalayim, Avigdor Banshek, who is an expert in obsessive-compulsive disorders as they affect the religious community. And he published a book in English, I think it's called Obsessive-Compulsive Disorders in Religious Observance. indeed, you have pointed out a phenomenon. Again, I'm not putting a clinical label on anybody, but if you look even at letters of the Stipler, they published letters of the Stipler. And in the 50s and 60s, he used to correspond with many yeshiva students who would ask him, Shilas, you will see that there may be over 100 different letters he wrote about anxiety disorders, about obsessive compulsions and the like, where people say, gee, I don't know if I was Yosei Shema, I read Shema 100 times today. And he basically, you know, talked about this. So you're 100% correct that there is, on one hand, Yiras Shemayim, which is wonderful and good. And there's, on the other hand, mental illness, which is not so good and needs to be treated. And it's sometimes not automatically the easiest thing to know the difference, but you are correct. This does exist as a phenomenon, and it needs to be addressed in a very important way. Okay, we'll see. Have a good day.